You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
It is Bach Week, and today we get to talk with Cantor Kevin Hildebrand of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and learn about how Bach has influenced him, shaped his life, and what he's learned from Bach. And we'll also get to talk about Bach in our daily lives, listening to Bach. How do we listen to Bach? Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University, Nebraska. You can learn more about Concordia University, Nebraska by visiting cune.edu. Joining us today, Cantor Kevin Hildebrand. He serves at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Cantor, welcome back to The Coffee Hour.
Thanks very much.
And welcome to Bach Week, too. This is a fun and exciting week for us in The Coffee Hour.
My favorite week of the year.
I believe someone said, who needs Shark Week when you have Bach Week, right?
Even better.
Well, let's talk about Bach in your life. How has Bach influenced you, your life, your work, your faith?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think any church musician doesn't really have a complete outlook on church or her music without having some kind of influence of Bach in his or her life. I think particularly as a Lutheran church musician, Bach is sort of omnipresent and in a way a sort of a guiding force and inspiration for all of us. I mean, even using the seminary's tradition is that we call the church musician is the cantor, and we use that same title that Bach and many others shared in the days of the Reformation and beyond. I think that not only Bach as a church musician, but Bach as a churchman is something that I really admire. There's lots of words have been printed, lots of ink been used, and I guess nowadays pixels used about Bach and his music. But Bach and his music and the faith is, I think, the most significant thing for me. And in my work at Concordia Theological Seminary and at St. Paul's in Fort Wayne, I would like to think that we're in a way following in Bach's footsteps. We follow in that tradition. We add to it in a way that we continue to sing the faith and sing it faithfully and look at Bach's model of creativity and composition and how he integrated creativity and God's gift of music and the proclamation of the faith. I think the more we all study Bach's music and his life and his work, I think it continues to inspire me. And sometimes it inspires me to go practice even more because, I mean, Bach's music is a lifelong study in and of itself. But just to you know, we talk about formation here at the seminary. Every institution of higher learning talks about how student formation is a key thing. And I think church music formation is highly influenced by Johann Sebastian Bach, and rightly so.
So let's talk more about formation. We like talking about formation here, and you've mentioned how Bach has really influenced probably most, if not all, church musicians to some degree in how they're formed, how they play, what they appreciate. Tell us about some of your formative experiences as a musician and how Bach played a role in how you've come to love and learn music.
Yeah. You know, I think back even to my childhood, and I grew up in rural southern Michigan, and the tradition of our congregation when I was a child is you remained seated after the service, and then the ushers would nod at you when it was your turn to leave and then go back and shake pastor's hand. Instead of everyone just sort of gets up and leaves at the same time. And just the tradition of our church organist at that time was she would play almost exclusively the so-called Little Eight preludes and fugues of what's attributed to Johann Sebastian Bach. There's some musicological debate over that, but that's another episode. And that was sort of like every week she'd just sort of start at the beginning and play through as many as it took to get through everybody leaving church, and then probably picked up where she left off the next week. And so that was sort of, I cut my musical teeth listening to that every week. And probably as a small child, you're sort of impatient to get out of church also, sadly. But that was filling that time. And I liked it. I remember that very, very well. And, you know, as I started, you know, taking piano lessons and then organ lessons, you know, another interesting thing was every piano, every organ student is not receiving a complete education if he or she doesn't have some music of Johann Sebastian Bach. It's just, I mean, he is a major force there that every musician needs to know. But somewhere along the way in high school, my teacher gave me a little certificate, which is not uncommon in the organ world, where you sort of trace your musical genealogy. Whereas for instance, my name is at the bottom, and then my teacher's name, her name was, you know, above that, my teacher, and then her teacher was listed above that. So it's sort of like a genealogical chart. And you keep going back to his teacher and his teacher, and it goes up the page all the way up to Johann Sebastian Bach. So, I mean, there's lots of people, which, I mean, I don't know what historical method they've used to trace this, but you can, you sort of like, this is my lineage. This is part of my story. And that's sort of fun. And then just as an organist, I mean, that was Bach's chief instrument, to be able to, you know, live and breathe and to continue to bring to life Bach's organ music in every generation. Every generation has to have, who are the players that are bringing this to life? And at your congregation or at the seminary or at this place, who's helping make this music happen? I'm very grateful to be able to be part of that, and in this day and age, to help bring Bach's music to life, along with many, many other people in our day and age. That's sort of how I view my role with Johann Sebastian Bach.
I never knew about this cantological succession that that you just described. This is fast. This is a secret of the organist world, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I guess so. Well, you guys, any sort of pedagogical lineage, you could look in many ways. You know, probably, you know, pastors might do that, like, who did I study with and who did he study with and so forth. But in the musician world, maybe it's sort of like it gives you a little more credentials or makes you think so.
Yeah. Let's talk about listening to Bach and enjoying good music like Bach. There is in the church today and in society too, there is good music, particularly when it comes to Bach, good and beautiful music. Why is it so easy for us to sometimes just let that wash over us? You were talking about the end of the service just a moment ago, and sometimes you're just eager to get out of the service and not really embracing the music and marveling at its beauty, but rather just either rushing through or just letting it wash over us and not really enjoy it. Why is it so easy to do that?
Because music is everywhere in our society and culture today. I mean, it's in your car. You put the little things in your ears and you've got your own playlist. It's on one hand, it's a wonderful thing, unprecedented in human civilization, that wherever you go, you can listen to just about whatever you want. And that's good. What it also has done is, you know, it's kind of like the stereotypical elevator music. You know, I don't know if elevators still have music in it, but, you know, it's in the background. You know, when I'm at the dentist, they put, you know, the music or the background maybe to calm you down. Or it, you know, at Menards, wherever you go, it's part of the background of our lives. And I would say, you know, sometimes in a negative way, sometimes that goes into then how we have music in the church. For instance, you know, music before the service, for a lot of people, it's, you know, it's what covers up the talking until something more important happens. You know, I'm amused in a sad way, if that's possible, that, you know, sometimes, well, here, I'll let you just in on the organist world. You know, I'm not really criticizing, but it is an observation. Sometimes there's a lot of chatter during, you know, the pre-service music and in a church service, and then the music stops, and what happens? People stop talking to listen to nothing. You know, and I'm all in favor of people being friendly, and so don't get me wrong about this. But I think that's why for many people, music just sort of washes over us. It's part of the background, but it's all, you know, anybody, any guy who's married, you know, can say, like, when your wife says, you know, you heard me, but you weren't listening. You know, I'm guilty of that. You know, and so we're also guilty of, we can hear a lot of music, but, you know, to be actively listening to it, you know, everyone is on a different spectrum of, you know, listening and hearing. And on one hand, we don't need always be super engaged with so-called active listening. It's okay when we have music in the background and it becomes part of our life. But what I really encourage people to appreciate and learn from any kind of music is to really not just hear it, but listen. And what are you listening for? I think for this topic, I always encourage people to listen to, if it is based on a hymn melody, for instance, where's the melody? Where do you hear it? For instance, in the famous, what we call now with an English translation, Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring. You know, it starts with this beautiful ritornello. Da-da-da-da-da-dee-dee-dee-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. All right? Then, after a few measures, then the melody comes in. And that's really a Lutheran chorale melody. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's where the melody is. All right. There's really two melodies happening. We have that beginning ritornello, and then we have the hymn melody. But that's sort of the first step, what I encourage people to, if they want to listen or listen better, how to listen, is find where is that melody? And where is it at? Is it in a high range? Is it in a low range? If it's played on the organ, is it a different stop? You know, is it something that, you know, is more striking? Is it louder? Is it softer? If it's played by an instrumental ensemble, we might even determine, oh, which instruments are playing that? If it's instruments in choir, or if it's organ in choir, we can listen to, well, what's the choir doing? You know, and where do the phrases of that hymn melody come in or go back and forth? That's the one of the first things that I encourage people in how to listen, to whether it's Bach or anything else, just to help make this not only something beautiful that washes over us, but helping us now be more informed about what we're listening to, perhaps.
And we'll talk more about this after we take a quick break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour during Bach Week. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
At Concordia University, Nebraska, discover a distinctly Christian community that equips students to live by faith with courage, character, and conviction. Intentionally combining our Christian faith, Lutheran heritage, rigorous academics, and practical real-life experiences, we prepare students to fulfill a higher purpose in their vocations and life. Learn more about Concordia University, Nebraska at our website, cune.edu. That's cune.edu.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
It is Bach Week on The Coffee Hour. We're talking with Cantor Kevin Hildebrand from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We're talking about how to listen to Bach. And you were telling us some really great insights into some things to listen for. And I want to go back just a second to this idea of background music and how studying music and intentionally paying attention to music, how that changes how we think about background music and what background music is.
Sure. Well, I mean, music is, we use it for so many, many things. And there are times and places in our lives where it's omnipresent, and to have it be, you know, in the background while we're doing something else is good and right and fine. But just think about all the other things where, you know, what if we treated, I don't know, you know, a sermon or, you know, a lecture or a presentation in class as background. If, you know, any teacher has the frustration of some student on their phone while you're trying to teach or presenting something, you're not really fully engaged in the process. Might you hear some things or pick up some things? Okay, fine. But even better is when we can really devote our attention to that. And everything that we do musically can't or won't be that way. But if we want to learn from it, and maybe to learn how to love it even more, anything that we're listening to, we do need to devote ourselves with our full attention in certain times and places. And this is a way when we want to focus on, like, for instance, this particular piece of repertoire, no matter who it's by, to be able to have even some guided listening of what I was mentioning before the break. What to listen for, you know, here is this instrument, here is this motive, here is this hymn melody. That helps what I think make the music more informative for us as we're formed by it.
So let's zero in on, particularly on Bach now. What insights do you have for understanding the significance of the music of J.S. Bach? Do you want to talk about organ or singing Bach first?
Perhaps, maybe let me talk a little bit about Bach cantatas, because, okay, I mean, there's a great tradition of Bach cantatas in the St. Louis area. There's a great tradition of that here at our campus and in many places. I have a course that I teach here at our seminary about the music of early Lutheranism, including Johann Sebastian Bach. And in Bach's day, when he was cantor at the churches in Leipzig, the cantata, and even in sort of casual usage today, a lot of churches will use the term cantata, meaning some like big multi-movement musical piece of repertoire, all right? And in Bach's day, in the era after the Reformation, the cantata in the Lutheran Church served as almost a musical proper of the day, just like we have, you know, the assigned scripture readings of the day. Then the cantata became sort of a sung proper, where there were certain texts that were prepared usually by a poet or a lyricist, a librettist. And there were a number of really quite gifted librettists in the churches in Leipzig. One of them was a lawyer, in fact, was his day job, but then he moonlighted as a cantata text compiler. And these would be usually combinations of a hymn, of scripture, then also a well-crafted, theologically informed poetry. And a composer would take those texts, and particularly with the scriptural text that was chosen and the poetical texts that were chosen, set those to music. And Bach was the master of doing that. And those would typically be sung following the reading or singing in Bach's churches of the Holy Gospel prior to the sermon. Sometimes longer cantatas would be split up before and after the sermon. Sometimes some longer ones would be sung during the distribution of the Lord's Supper. And we have about 200 of Bach's cantatas that exist to this day. He wrote 5 annual cycles of cantatas, many of which have been lost. But you think there's 52 Sundays in a year plus festivals. They would not be sung during the Sundays in Lent. They would be sung only on the first Sunday of Advent, but not on the subsequent Sundays. So, yeah, I mean, do the math, about 50 a year times 5 years, about 250. There's about 200 that are extant. And we enjoy, you know, continuing to perform them to this day. I always think probably the, like, an entry level of how to get started listening to or being introduced to Bach cantatas is to find one based on a hymn melody that you know. One of the best, I think, to get started is there's one based on A Mighty Fortress, Ein Feste Burg, cantata number 80. Or there's another one based on Wake Awake, For Night Is Flying, cantata 140, Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. Or, you know, just find a list of Bach cantatas and having some familiarity with those hymn melodies in German might be, you know, the next learning curve in there. But it's like, oh, I know this one, or I know this one. That's how I encourage people to get started with finding a cantata.
That is great advice, to find ones that are based on hymn tunes. There are several that will sound familiar, which is always helpful. And there's some available in English if you look on YouTube, so you can actually kind of get a gist for what's happening too.
Right. There's, and sometimes performing ensembles will perform a cantata in its original language in German, sometimes in an English translation. When listening to any music in a foreign language, you have to have a translation right in front of you. And, you know, good places that do performances of cantatas will have in the bulletin in the service folder, you know, a side-by-side translation, so you can follow along. And sometimes you can even hear then in the music, here there's something about, like, for instance, in cantata 106, God's Own Time is the best time. There's a movement where the bass soloist is singing the words of Jesus to the thief on the cross. "Surely I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." And while that bass solo is singing the words of Jesus, the soprano section of the choir is singing the hymn melody of Luther's version of the Nunc Dimittis, "In peace and joy I now depart." And the last line of that chorale says, "So now death to me is but a slumber." Right? And when you get to that part, the German word for slumber, Schlaf, sleep, right, just sort of holds out on one note for a long time, and it doesn't move, and it's not doing anything. It's just sitting there. And to know what that word means, and when you have a side-by-side translation, like, oh, now I understand, that makes it even more, what I think, interesting and meaningful to see how that word is brought to life that way through the music.
Absolutely. We have a few minutes left to talk about organ, listening to all of the beautiful organ works that Bach has done. Do you have any insights or hints on how to listen to those well?
Sure. And Bach's organ music spans both the things that are hymn-based and non-hymn-based. Like the other things we've been talking about in our visit today, it's probably most familiar or easy to listen to when you start with something that you know, especially something based on a hymn melody. And there's no shortage of music of Bach and others that are based on hymn tunes. In fact, a nice tie-in with the cantatas, there is a collection of six organ pieces of Bach that were originally based on cantata movements. They're nicknamed the Schubler Chorales, nicknamed after the publisher who published these within Bach's lifetime. His name was Schubler. And in a way, these were sort of like the greatest hits of Johann Sebastian Bach from his cantatas that had popular acclaim, that people said, we want to hear more of this. And so Bach arranged them for organ solo, not just for, you know, the small orchestra and choir. One of which was from that cantata movement I mentioned earlier, cantata 140, "Awake, awake, for night is flying." One of the inner movements is this famous movement that's based on the hymn tune, and it has that memorable introduction or ritornello, that da 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 da, before the hymn melody takes off. That, and there's several others that sort of are those greatest hits for the cantatas based on hymn melody. So those are great places to start. Then there's lots of, you know, preludes and fugues, or fantasias, or toccatas, or sonatas that are free based. They're not based on a hymn melody, but those, to listen to those, I'll often say, well, okay, listen to what's happening. And even though it's not based on a hymn melody, we can find, well, what's the musical melody or idea that Bach is playing around with here? Especially once you get to the fugue section of the, like, prelude and fugue, or toccata and fugue. What's a fugue? Well, a fugue is, I mean, that's a musical form where a composer takes a small musical idea and then plays around with it and has lots of fun. In a way, I think those are easier to listen to than, you know, a toccata, a prelude, a fantasia, which is sort of more free-flowing and it can go in many different directions. A fugue, in a way, is sort of more defined, all right? And you have this little melodic phrase, and it starts out in one key, and then it goes in another key, and then it goes back to the original key, and it's sort of how many different ways can the composer take this little musical idea and play around with it. You hear it bouncing around all over the place, changing keys, changing modes, changing directions. Once in a while, Bach will even have it go backwards. And sometimes you don't even know it's happening unless somebody points it out to you. I mean, I really thought, the hallmark of a master composer, when you can take this little musical idea and treat it in so many different ways, in that's the and fugue part of those compositions with those titles.
All right, based on everything that you've shared with us today, we have just about a minute left. What's one piece that we should go search for and listen to this week?
Wow. You know, that's sort of like asking, you know, like, which...
Your favorite child, know, yes.
Well, kind of like that. One thing I haven't mentioned yet is it's the center movement of Cantata 79. Cantata 79 is Gott der Herr ist Sonne und Schild. God the Lord is Sun and Shield. And the middle movement is Now Thank We All Our God. Right, and I say that just because I would hope that most people know that hymn melody. I also encourage that to, like, most church choirs that can sing in four parts, that is a piece of a Bach cantata that any church choir that can sing in four parts can handle. There's a lot of music that you know, maybe even an amateur choir, you know, could stretch their limits, but this is one that I really think that most church choirs that are singing four parts, they can handle that. And it's a delightful, refreshing, easily accessed arrangement that I really take a lot of delight in.
Our guest today, Cantor Kevin Hildebrand of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thank you so much for spending this time with us this week on Bach Week.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.